stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Well, 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 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, as Andre Hakes enjoys her well-deserved Saturday, rainy Saturday off. That's what happens when you're a lawyer. She's probably not off. She's probably working. But today, I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm sitting in as a special guest host. Andre, I hope to do you proud. I'm going to bring a show in today that has been 25 years in the making. I'm honored to be joined by Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Noted psychologist, retired, right, Jeff?
Yes.
Noted retired psychologist here in town. Jeff and I, for the past 25 years, have been working with our local sex offender population. This is a show about sex offenders, sex offending, and all things regarding to the treatment, predation, what else?
Risk.
Exactly. So I'll tell you that Jeff and I have spent many years working together. Dr. Frazier, pardon me, we have two Jeffs today. And oftentimes we are known to share coffee in the downtown mall sitting outside. And sometimes people will get up and move after they overhear our conversation. And sometimes people will move closer. Just depends on what they feel like listening to.
And sometimes we see our clients walking down the mall.
And they always stop and chat. So, Jeff, give us your background. Dr. Frazier, give us your background. Where did you start? You were in New Jersey for a while as part of the parole board, too, for a while.
I was.
So let us know.
After in completing my graduate study in the late 70s, I went to Rutgers Medical School in central New Jersey to do my internship. And a year there turned into 11. And my first rotation as an intern was with the sexual disorders clinic there, so it was sort of serendipitous. And the supervisor there, he and I worked well together, so I ended up staying on there in a position, and that's where I began working with this population. And out of that came an opportunity to serve on the parole board for the state of New Jersey, for the institution there, the Adult Diagnostic and Treatment Center in Avondale, New Jersey, which is a specific dedicated treatment center for sex offenders. And we moved back here in 89, and there wasn't anybody really doing this kind of work. And so by default, I part of my specialization was working with evaluation and treatment of both sex offenders, but also victims of sexual assault.
So I've been sitting in on cases for many years in both the Charlottesville and Almar Circuit Courts, and it was not uncommon for the judge to be taking testimony and then just stop the case and just say, all right, whoa, we got to get Dr. Frazier involved in this case. So then the person that was on trial or getting sentenced would be returned to jail, and they would come to your office in shackles and with jail officers there.
Correct.
And what I always wanted to ask you was, when you've got a person, 99% of the time it's a male who has either committed a pretty heinous crime, and they're in shackles, and you're trained as a therapist, how do you even begin to develop rapport with someone who's got their hands cuffed around their waist?
Well, the first thing was I would always ask the officers request that they remove the handcuffs and the hand shackles. They could keep the legs on. They would post, I had two doors to my office, they would post an officer at either door. And never had a problem. I mean, there was one that someone who was being taken back to the jail from my office escaped, and the police thought somehow that there might have been a key secreted away in my building. Turned out not to have been the case. But other than that, over 27 years, it was never really a problem.
Yeah, but when they come in, you're talking to them about stuff that they've been repressing for decades.
Correct.
You know, they talk about their own history of victimization, or they talk about,
yes,
10 or 20 or 30 or 50 victims that they have in their wake before they finally got caught. And now you're, in a matter of 4 hours, are attempting to get them to open up to you. I mean, that takes skill.
Well, you do it enough, you know, but I mean, you know, you spend the first few minutes just trying to sort of settle everything down, acknowledge, you know, why we're here, acknowledge that my role is neutral. I'm not mm-hmm. working for his attorney or the Commonwealth. The judge asked me to do this evaluation. And you build a rapport. I mean, just over time, most people, you know, want to be validated in some way. Right. And I will acknowledge this is a tough time for you. I mean, let's stipulate that, and then let's move on with the evaluation.
You know, I think that's a great I think you hit on the key point is when they want to be validated, they also want to be heard.
Absolutely.
And everyone has a story that they most 99% of people have a story that they want to tell.
They absolutely do.
And our job is to find the keys that allow them to tell that story.
Yeah.
And if you overlay any judgment, it's done.
Right.
If they tell you, well, yeah, first of all, you're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. And if there are wee ones around, this is adult content. We're going to be talking about sex offenders, sexual predilection. And also, if you are a victim of sexual assault listening to this, make sure that you take self-care. Because we are going to be talking about topics that could hurt. And I'm sure out there somewhere there'll be people that Jeff and I have both worked with over the years that are listening. So, you know, you guys take self-care too. Because when our job is done and we have been successful at helping you move past, you know you've caused hurt. And that's the hardest thing to do when you're dealing with sex offenders is to get them to look at their victim as actual victims.
Right. And, you know, I would typically begin by acknowledging, you know, that again, without judgment, and that you hit on that, that's absolutely key. But also try to say, I want to understand your life. What's been your life story? Because, as you said, you know, not all people who have been sexually abused as children grow up to be offenders. But the vast majority of offenders themselves had a history of sexual assault in their lives.
And that's something that they have never, they've spent an entire life protecting. That is their secret. And to get them, and you never know when that secret begins to roll, how it's going to go. You know, suicide comes into play. Their sort of risk profile tends to, Jeff's nodding, by the way, tends to escalate.
Yes.
And you really have to, when people begin, you can't just walk in and say, tell me, were you molested as a child?
Right.
How do you begin that conversation and navigate it through to where they finally admit what they have done, and then they turn that into sort of a healing acknowledgement that they don't want to do it again?
Well, my tact was always to talk about that first, and I would begin making a general statement about, you know, the majority of people that are sitting in your chair have a history of having been molested themselves, and really normalize it to the extent that they can, you know, feel okay to talk about.
Right. I expect to hear it.
Yep. Tell me about your experience. I wouldn't say, did it happen? I would say, tell me what happened to you as a child. Tell me who touched you, who you know, did something to you. And, you know, you'd be surprised. They, as you say, they want to talk about it. And it could be intense. I mean, there were many times I would call back to the jail after the evaluation to the mental health folks there, to Dr. Juanita Morris, and say, you know, John Doe's on his way back. You need to keep an eye on him. He's mm-hmm. pretty rattled this morning.
Yeah, he's vulnerable. You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC. I'm Jeff Leonard, sitting in for Andre Hakes. I got Dr. Jeffrey Frazier with me. Juanita Morris. Dr. Morris, love her. Worked
yes,
with her for many
terrific.
Years.
Well,
hello, Juanita, if you're out there listening, Dr. Morris. So, last night I sat down and I was scribbling out notes because this show came together at the last minute. Thank you for coming. It took 20 years for us to get to this point, but it came together at the last 12 minute.
12 hours to get it on the air.
So I was scribbling down some notes while I was sitting at home, and I had about two or three legal pads full of stuff that you and I have worked with over the years. So I've got a few questions, but you know, you've worked with both victims and with sex offenders.
Yes.
And you know, one of the things I want to ask you is, what do you do for self-care? But when you come in, oftentimes they're kind of the same.
They are. And you know what it does, Jeff? It allows you to really strike a balance because you're hearing it from both sides. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's heartbreaking with both. I mean, people, you know, sex offenders are not a popular constituency in the world. But you know what? They're human beings and they're hurting human beings. People that have been hurt, you know, that expression.
Right.
I mean, these guys don't just wake up one day and decide they're going to do it. They're damaged individuals. And then you see a damaged individual, mostly a child or mostly a woman or a girl. And it really allowed me to balance. I think too often, if you just see one group mm-hmm. with the other, you get very skewed in your thinking. And it was really a way for me to kind of you know, keep a level playing field.
Yeah, that's happened to me in my, I respect immensely Susan Painter, Maggie Cullinan, Rob Morrow, yes. Charlottesville Victim Witness Coordinators, and their staff. People think we have a hard job.
Yes.
They have the most difficult job. I mean, what I tell them, or I'll tell anybody that'll listen, is they meet good people in really awful situations.
Yes.
And you meet people at the absolute worst time in their lives. And, you know, this is the... They meet people every week that are having the worst time ever, and after a while, that definitely has got to take its toll.
Oh, you know, I mean, it's a tough job. I mean, the stuff they're hearing and the stuff they're saying, you know, the whole business is tough, and it requires people that are committed to doing this job. I mean, I want to say to our listeners that, you know, the collaboration that you and I had over those years was just somewhat unique and such an effective. You know, the teamwork that we're able to do was so effective, and you know, it's pretty soon the area is going to be without that, and you know, and not to toot our own horn there, but to be able to pick up the phone, you to me or me to you, and talk about a case or collaborate on a case or go into court having collaborated on a case, yeah, you know, that's the gold standard.
It really is, and there is. We didn't always disagree. We didn't always agree.
Correct.
And we didn't always agree with the prosecutor, and we didn't always agree with the defense attorney. But one of the things that Charlottesville, I hope, maintains is that we were able to sort of disagree respectfully.
Yes.
And put it all out. Our job wasn't to conclude anything. Our job was to present all the options and let Judge Petros or Judge Hogshire or Judge Higgins, let them make the decision.
Yes.
And so talking, again, you're listening to the Straight Talk, 94.7 WPVC, and I'm the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Jeff Leonard sitting in with Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, talking about sexual how do you pronounce that word?
Predation.
Predation. Sorry about that. After all these years, you figure I'd know that. So, one of the things, sex offenders are, the sex offender supervision, sex offender risk assessment is sort of the gold standard in the new evidence-based practice move, the criminal justice. It is evidence-based driven, data-driven management. So what is the static 99?
So the static 99, so what's been fascinating for me over the course of my 43-year career was the evolution of this field and of the sophistication over that period of time. You know, when I started out, it was fly by the seat of your pants. You know, there were few of us even doing the work, and it's just grown and grown in a really productive way. The Static 99 is an instrument. It's what we call an actuarial instrument, meaning it's kind of a checklist where you're going through a number of risk factors based upon years and years of research. And you basically see if that risk factor is present. And based upon that, we can do a pretty decent job of predicting future risk of reoffending.
So they took thousands and thousands of sex offenders in Canada.
Thousands.
Studied them, looked at what they had in common.
Correct.
And created if they had a male, child, unrelated, unknown victim.
If they were under a certain age of 25.
Right. So
you know, if they had prior offenses. I mean, all these things are fairly robust predictors of
violence.
Recidivism. Violence.
Who your victim was. So if you are, and this is a little inside baseball, but we're going to talk a little bit about civil commitment, and the Static 99 is a test that the state of Virginia uses to either include in or exclude individuals who, after they serve their time, could wind up in the state mental health sex offender position.
In a secure facility for an indefinite, indeterminate period of time.
To for the rest of their natural life,
yeah.
Which you know, we can talk about in a second. But the Static 99, it's a risk assessment tool. And validated risk assessment tools are not foolproof.
They are not.
They're what, 75% accurate?
If that. One case I always like to cite with regard to this instrument is, for those of you that have been around a while, remember the Charlottesville rapist, the so-called Charlottesville rapist, who had committed multiple violent rapes, and when I evaluated him, in fact, said that he'd probably aborted three times that because it looked too risky. But when I evaluated him, and this is a very serious offender, He didn't show up as being at risk on the Static 99. He was older. He had no priors. I mean, he didn't have substance abuse. He didn't. I mean, you know, you go into court and say, "Your Honor, you know, I'm sorry, this guy is not at risk based on this instrument, based upon my clinical judgment. You know, he should never see the light of day again.
So one of the questions I have to ask you is when you and I are sitting there in the room with someone who all the risk assessments are clean. This person, you know, you're right, he's old. He has known victims.
There's no criminal record.
No history of violence. But yet the hair on the back of your neck stands up.
Yes.
And that's millennia of human, whatever it is, just telling you something's wrong here.
Yes.
What do you do?
Well, you know, I will say that my reports would always indicate that, you know, the risk assessment in this case should be taken with a grain of salt because, you know, other instruments that we've used, you know, psychopathy checklists and whatnot, again, not to get too far down in the weeds, in my own clinical experience, and often my assistant would be in the office, and she was a woman, and I would check with her, and because oftentimes the hair on her neck would stand up when mine wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But it would be a matter of clinical judgment just to say to the court, I realize he didn't score high on the 99, but everything else tells me we need to supervise and give this guy to Jeff Leonard under strict supervision if we're not going to put him in jail.
But that opens you up to defense attorneys.
Absolutely.
See that, and they come at you. They would come at you aggressive, and they should.
They
need to provide a rigorous defense. And if we're going to rely on these validated risk assessment tools, so let's say someone is a high risk to let you know what we look at when people are on the street and they're on sex offenders, then they are sex offenders, is let's say you're a 5 on the static, so you're a high risk to reoffend.
Yes.
So there's a 75% chance that there is a 40% chance that you're going to reoffend. I don't know how to do that math, but high risk is 25 to what, 40% chance of reoffending?
Correct.
So when someone comes in your office, again, Straight Talk, 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, Andre Hakes is not here. Jeff Leonard is sitting with Dr. Jeffrey Frazier talking about sex offenders. Show 20 years in the making. So when someone is in your office and they score, what are the three, outside of the validated risk assessment tools, what are the three biggest predictors of reoffense? I know psychopathy is one of them.
It is. And, you know, I always, when I teach, I always say to the group, what's the single most powerful predictor of sex offending? And they come up with lists and lists and lists. And when I'm done, I say, no, it's gender. The single most robust predictor is gender. Yes, it's a trick question. But in fact, males commit about 99.5% of sex offenses. So we've got gender, we've got age, younger,
right,
more risk. And a lot of these guys, you've seen it in your work, age out. You know, now they've been at this, now they're 55 years old, they age out. And then priors. And priors comes under the heading of psychopathic tendencies. You know, psychopaths are people that have no empathy, they're glib, they're uncaring. You know, we have a whole checklist for them as well.
Yeah, the hair psychopathy. They walk around. It's really interesting when you sort of penetrate some of the psychopathy guys, and they start to realize that, yeah, I was raised by my dad who taught me to view everyone I've ever come in contact with as a victim.
As a victim, yep.
What can I take from them? What can I get from them? How can I leverage this interaction with this person I just met to my advantage, and I don't care whether it injures them or what. As long as I get what I want, I can move on.
Yeah. I remember a case not too long ago of a man that had molested his girlfriend's child. And when I confronted him about it, he said, what's the problem? I just ripped off a little sex from her. Big deal. She was 7 years old.
And, you know, people out there listening are like, how did you sit there with that guy? Didn't you want to kill that guy?
Psychopaths are very hard to feel compassion for. You really have to work to say, okay, behind all this, you know, we now have, and it blew up again yesterday, a psychopathic sexual predator running for president of the United States. I realize this is not a political show, but I have to say, if those of you listening, if you look, hear the transcript and look at this guy's history, there's the case for you right in
so
front.
So when does a, I've seen, you and I have talked about this, so you've, from afar and in a armchair sort of way, diagnosed Mr. Trump as a narcissist.
Yeah, with psychopathic tendencies.
So narcissism, as I understand it, is sort of on the road to psychopathy.
Yes.
At what point does a narcissist enter the diagnosis of a psychopath?
You know, it's not a clean, bright line, Jeff. And, you know, now under the new DSM-5, we've kind of blurred the personality disorders, so it's kind of mixed in there. But he, you know, it's there are a lot of narcissists out there selling cars, you know, being artists, mm-hmm. being entertainers that are not... They're very self-centered and very self-absorbed. They're not hurting as many people as someone who doesn't care when they don't pay a vendor who's just giving them, you know, pianos for your hotels, or who talks about women in, as though they're objects that he can go up and grab them in various body parts and on and on. I mean, he is sort of his narcissism is everything is about him, and he could give a damn about anyone else or anything else, and that scares the heck out of me.
So and we're going to take a break here in a second, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about deviant sexual arousal. But what I want to say, when I was watching Mr. Trump in the video last night, was that there are people out there, there are ladies out there right now that this happened to.
With him
and with others.
Millions
of them, millions, probably.
Yes.
And
certainly.
They were subjected probably last night to some post-traumatic stress.
To some re-traumatization listening to or hearing
because,
about this.
Because not only did you have this man on television saying that it's okay to sexually assault people, but then you had surrogates defending it. And then these people who were sexually assaulted are like, how can anyone defend? So they relived what they went through. So to that extent, that's what I thought of when I watched that last night.
I think
that guy is exactly who we think he is.
Yes.
But the fact that he just put tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who have experienced sexual assault in a position to relive that assault, to relive that trauma, I will never be able to forgive him or anyone who defends that.
And for them to fear that this man may become president of the United States. Can you imagine if
and
you've
make
been
that
a victim
sort
of
sexual norm.
Trauma? I mean, it's horrible.
It really is. So 94.7 Straight Talk. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So you're right. If you want to call in, I've got a headset here. I should probably put this on delay so that we can take some phone calls. But if you want to call in, 284-9470. We'll try to take your calls. So I'm here with Jeff Leonard, here with Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, talking sex offenders. I will say with all humility, Jeff and I are the experts in town. If you don't believe us, call us up, invite us for coffee, sit in the downtown mall with us one day. And we will point out everyone that walks down the mall quietly,
right,
professionally, and a lot of them will come up who happen to be on the sex offender registry and sit with us and talk and catch up.
And hopefully tell us how well they're doing.
Right. And if they're not doing well, typically they're in jail.
Exactly.
So one of the biggest, in my experience, risk predictors of future sexual assault, because everyone always asks me, and probably you, can you fix sex offenders?
Right.
My answer is no. But what you can do is you can mostly manage their risk.
Exactly.
To a point where they can be in the community. And those who risk can't be managed really have no business.
None.
Being around my daughter, your kids,
anybody.
So one of the biggest risk predictors I've seen is deviant sexual arousal.
Correct.
What is that?
So one of the parts of our evaluation is we use one of two instruments, and again, I won't get too wonky here, but to measure deviant arousal, meaning if I show you pictures of a child or if I read you a script involving a child, do you get turned on?
Right.
Do you show sexual interest, sexual arousal to that situation? And especially if you've come in with allegations or conviction now that against children. Or if you come in with a conviction for rape, do you show arousal to violence? Do you show violence toward women, violence towards children? It's a critical piece of the puzzle. And as you said, that's not going away. It's going to be in a perfect world. They will learn to manage it. They will learn to manage it through therapy, through strict supervision by a probation officer, by time hanging over their head, you know, in terms of risk to be reincarcerated. But it's a big deal.
It is. And so to know what I think we all have a pretty good idea when I go to the Crozet PTA or when I go to whoever calls to come talk to their civic organization about what it is that dealing, because this is what happens is when a sex offender moves into a neighborhood, everybody panics.
Yes.
And they call us. They call you. They call me. They call the police. They call everybody that'll listen. So what I try to tell them is you don't want to raise their risk sort of profile. So when you put them under pressure, so the people are like, well, I'm going to put pamphlets up everywhere. I'm going to put signs up. Well,
I'm going to egg his house.
Yeah. So do that. But understand that when you do that, you're raising their anxiety level. You are raising their everything about them that makes them more risky. So if you want to increase the likelihood of their reoffending, go ahead.
And here's the problem, Jeff, with that. If you put someone back in the community and they can't get housing because no one will rent to them because they're a sex offender, they can't get work, they're going to end up living under the free bridge. Now, do you think that's not a stressful lifestyle?
No, it goes back to Maslow.
Exactly. And do you know what's going to happen if they're living under the free bridge? They're going to reoffend because that's the only coping mechanism that they have, sad to say.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
If you're going to treat me like a pariah,
I'm going to be a pariah.
And so when I go to these places, I always ask people to close your eyes and in your mind's eye, pick your ideal sexual partner, okay? For me, if you see my wife, it's tall, athletic women, okay? And I always norm on myself. For you,
yes.
I'm sure you can name your ideal sort of sexual attraction. When some of these guys close their eye and are asked to describe their ideal sexual partner, they come up with children.
They do.
Or they come up with violence.
Or they come up with exposing themselves or peeping in windows. I mean, there's a whole another world of sex offenses that we probably won't have time to talk
about.
Fetishisms, yes.
And those guys are the hardest ones to penetrate.
Yes.
Because they don't see what they're doing as
wrong or
as harmful.
Right.
So how do you convince someone that what you're doing is wrong and harmful when they're sort of entracted in the position that they are correct?
You know, you and I had a case some years ago of a guy that repeatedly was a peeping Tom. And, you know, he never accepted that it was anything wrong. He didn't understand that he was traumatizing people on whom he was peeping.
All right. So one of the risk. So what our job is to figure out what sort of when you want to break down denial, I didn't do it. OK, very common for someone to come in and say, I didn't do it. So then the first thing you want to do is look at what their risk level is. So part of that is to go through the either the ABLE or the penalpathismograph to figure out what they are sexually attracted to. Now if you want to knock out the ABLE, I'll handle the PPG.
Okay. So one of the things we do is there's a procedure called the ABLE assessment of sexual interest, and we show pictures of children, people bound up, a range of pictures, and measure visual reaction time, which is how long in milliseconds that they look at that image. And there's a correlation between how long they look at that image in milliseconds and their sexual interest in that category of individuals, let's say male children.
Right.
And from that we can deduce and confront them with, if they're still in denial, like, hey, John, you say it didn't happen. Why are you showing strong sexual interest in little boys?
Right, you did. So, and what the penalpathismograph is learning adult content. I'm going to say penis. So what the penalpathismograph is a mercury-laden telemetry strip that an evaluator will put on a man's genital and then show them images, much like the ABLE, and those images measure, I mean, the
blood flow
in a man's, it doesn't take much to get men sexually active.
Correct.
Okay. It's a pretty low threshold response. Especially if you're young, and that's why the young guys are so
higher risk.
Right.
They got lots of testosterone going on.
So when you look at when we do this PPG, we'll show them the same images as the ABLE, but we'll also put sort of sounds in their ears. So, like, if you have if a guy begins to get aroused to a child to a playground with, like, "Yay, Timmy, throw me the ball! Yay, Timmy, throw! Yay, let's play!" So they're more like groomers.
Yeah, you know,
they want to get to these they want to have sex with children. But they don't want to, they're not going to snatch a kid to do it.
Right.
They want to groom the child.
Seduce the child.
Right. It's a courting.
It's a courting behavior.
It is. And so that's where you know, okay, for this guy shouldn't be around those situations. I mean, if the guy should be on the street at all, he shouldn't be, there are certain things you have to take things you have to put in place to avoid him being in those circumstances. Now, when we show the same images to somebody and there are, again, adult content ahead, and there are sounds of violence, there are sounds of injury, there are pleas to stop. Those, and I get worried just talking about it.
Oh yeah,
those are the guys that are going to take the kids.
Yes,
and those are the guys that enjoy sort of inflicting pain with their, and we don't come across those very often.
I was going to say the good news is they're rare. The bad news is they are a huge risk. Dangerous, bad people. Unfortunately, they get way too much press because it sort of allows people to then ignore the fact that most offenders know their victims know their offenders. But yeah, those are the guys that keep me up at night.
Yeah, those are the guys that when you, so everyone when everyone hears sex offenders, this is what come. Those are the guys that come to their mind.
Correct.
But those guys aren't 5%, 8%,
2 or 3%.
So we don't come across those guys very often.
Correct.
But when we do, we have to take good care with those guys.
We sure do, and get them off the street.
So, and those are the guys that lead into civil commitment usually. So for what civil commitment is, in the state of Virginia, and on probably
every other state by now.
I don't know. There's not a federal statute for it yet, but I think there is all the states.
Yes.
So at the end, let's say you've been convicted of a crime. It's five crimes. It's rape, inanimate object sexual penetration, forcible sodomy, carnal knowledge, and aggravated sexual battery. Right. If you've been convicted of one of those crimes and you are going to get released from your Department of Corrections sentence, and your risk assessment is such, you're a five or above on the static, they're going to send you to someone like Dr. Frazier, and tell us what happens.
So it now becomes a civil procedure, and one of the reasons is because if we're at a second criminal procedure, the Supreme Court has ruled that it would be double jeopardy. So they send them to me, they send them to this, and I'm usually going to be the defendant's expert, and they're going to send them to the Commonwealth or the Attorney General's expert, and we're going to do battling experts do a full evaluation, including measuring deviant sexual interest, measuring future risk, measuring psychopathy. And then we're going to come back to the court and report whether or not, A, they meet the standard for a sexually violent predator. And that includes, you know, they have to have some sort of mental health diagnosis and they have to be deemed, a sexual predator.
Right.
And then, and if so, what's the least restrictive setting in which they can be safely put? Meaning, can they be managed in the community? Or do they have to be sent away to a secure facility? Now, in all the ones I did, I never found a judge that was willing to take the risk to them of putting someone in the community with a sexually violent predator label on. I think that you may have had a different experience of that, Jim.
Well, you know, if you're a judge, and I think one of the I heard one of the judges say, and I won't call her or his name out, but he remarked that, you know, what fool judge is going to let someone out when they've got experts in the field telling me that this person represents a too high of a risk to be released.
Right.
So, and if you're a defense attorney, that's a pretty Herculean task is to overcome two experts, the attorney general's office and the judge, being against you. And,
You know, the problem now is the facility's getting so crowded. There's a special facility called the Virginia
BCBR. Virginia Center for Behavioral Rehabilitation in Burkeville, Virginia.
Yes. They've gotten so crowded, you know, something's got to give here. It's sort of like the sex offender registry, which we should probably talk about for
sure.
A couple minutes. But, you know, I think when I started, when the registry was put in, there were maybe five predicate offenses that would get you on the registry. I think when I last checked, there were 24.
Yeah, they all had to be violent.
Now they can be, you know, almost anything sexually related. Now, you know, sex offenders are not a popular constituency that people are going to Richmond saying, don't put more people in the
register.
Yeah,
they don't have the advocacy group in Richmond, no.
But the problem with doing, you know, less violent or nonviolent offenders is it's essentially a life sentence. You know, that follows them for the rest of their life.
It does.
And, you know, I understand the public safety issues. I was involved with a case in New Jersey that created Megan's Law. It was a horrible case. But when we start putting lesser offenses on there rather than, you know, alternatives, I have some problem with that just in terms of the impact of having that label on you for the rest of your life.
So what I tell people is, you know, the sex offender registry is everyone's on there at least twice because your home and your employment has to be registered. So if you're downtown Charlottesville and you Google, you know, or you look at the Virginia State Police Sex Offender Registry, there's going to be hundreds of them within, you know, 2 or 3 mile radius.
Yeah.
Because people work and sometimes they have more than one job. So each job is registered. But my concern with the registry is that the guy we were talking about who actually is that fixated, violent perpetrator against children is on the registry next to the guy who wrote the book and How to Screw Up Your Life in 10 Minutes or Less.
Yes.
And there's really no way to delineate between the two unless you really begin to dig down, you know, through the use of the Google machine.
Right.
As to who they are and what risk level they represent. When the sex offender registry first came out, carnal knowledge was considered a nonviolent offense. So carnal knowledge and some of the other nonviolent offenses, or the Code of Virginia delineates what's violent, not violent, not us.
Right.
There was a backdoor registry. The registry wasn't, but then, goodness gracious.
What is it?
Probably 10 years, 15 years ago, they opened it up to all the, it became public knowledge.
Yeah.
So all these guys that were, you know, pled guilty to crimes a long time ago.
Retroactively,
they got put on. So we went from, how did we go from having, you know, 64 sex offenders in Charlottesville to 164 is the law changed.
Yeah. And here's where, I'll give you an example of where I think it can be really tragic. I had a couple of these cases. The boy's 18, the girlfriend's 16. A girl's mom and dad find out that they're having sex. You know, they charge the kid. He's convicted or he pleads. And now he's on the registry for having, you know, this kid is not a rapist. He's not a violent offender. He had sex, yes, with an underage person who happens to be his girlfriend. And does he really belong on a registry? I mean, he's 18 years old. His life is
yeah, he's, you know, college. It does. Yeah. It has, you know, it's. It reminds me of, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail.
Nail.
So,
and this guy, what does this guy have in common with Jesse Matthew? Nothing.
Right. And you are, I don't know if you can talk about that, but you were involved in that a little bit.
Yes, pretty extensively. I was the Commonwealth's expert, in-house expert on that case, and I'm telling you, that's one that'll make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I still think there are cases out there that have never been resolved of offenses that and sexually motivated murders that he committed that we'll never know the answer to. But he'll never be back out again. He's got 4 consecutive life sentences.
Yeah, he's presently at Red Onion. So,
tough place. Level 5, meaning the toughest.
It is not an easy place. You're listening to Straight Talk, 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, talking about all things sex offender related. Now we've got two. I'm gonna say one word after this break, and the one word is internet.
Oh boy.
So if there's any one thing in the past 6 or 7 years that has changed sex offender supervision, sex offender assessment, it is the internet.
It is indeed.
And we're gonna talk about that when we come back. Stay with us.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
Andre Hakes taking a much-needed day off. My guess is she's not taking a day off. My guess is she is at her office preparing big cases she tends to get because she is one of the superior attorneys here in town. 94.7 Straight Talk. I am Jeff Leonard. Sitting here with Dr. Jeffrey Frazier talking everything sex offender. So, Jeff, we teased before we left to talk about the internet. Tell us what's going on the internet.
Oh, golly. I mean, this over the course of my career to see the how that's evolved and developed and the readiness and the ease with which violent pornography, all types of pornography can be seen and accessed. And I have concerns that go on and on. You know, but certainly trying to manage a sex offender in the community post-release that you and I would work with, you know, how do we keep them off the internet? You know, these guys cannot be looking at pornography if we're trying to keep them from reoffending.
Yeah,
their deviant arousal is going to get triggered. And guess what? They can find pornography that suits their deviant arousal. There's everything on the internet for every imaginable deviant.
Instantaneously. You know, we are some of the community supervision, you know, the judges will say, no internet access, which really, you can't go to Whole Foods and swipe your card without using the internet. So that really is kind of hard. But when people, there's this software called Covenant Eyes or something mm-hmm. that you can have on your computer at home that, you know, alerts you to, that won't let you go to, it's adult software. It's software so your kids can't go to
right.
see these sites.
Net Nanny, all those kinds of sites.
But the issue is that you and I just checked our cell phones at the break. Those things are portable computers. You can go to the downtown library. The downtown mall has free internet access. You can't. So all you have to do is walk down to any of these places with a smartphone that you can get at 7-Eleven and hit on an open wireless account and put in a search term for a female body part in Google Images, and millions of them will pop up in 0.8 of a second. So that's the one challenge, I think, that going forward.
Huge. And I'm all for freedom of the press, but you know what? This stuff is poison. You know, my biggest concern, Jeff, is with mostly underage boys looking at this stuff starting at 9, 10, or 11. Their little brains, you know, when we evolved as human beings, the most sexual thing was the female across the savannah, you know,
right.
in a bear skin. That's all my brain had to process. Now kids can get online and look at the most graphic stuff. Their little brains are not equipped to manage this kind of stimuli.
It desensitizes them.
It desensitizes them. And I saw a big blip up in juvenile sex offenders through the juvenile courts over the last 10 years. And to a child, they had been looking at this stuff extensively. It had resulted in them acting out sexually. And that's my biggest worry. What is it doing to our children, and what is it doing to their attitude about sex, their ability to control their sexual impulses? It's a nightmare.
It is. And they don't. So you're dealing with a 12 or 13 year old who is a violent pornography consumer, and they don't know the difference. Their brain is just like, oh, well, it's on the internet. It must be normal.
Yes.
And then they're
getting overstimulated. All these kids end up being hypersexual. I mean, they are so preoccupied after looking at this stuff for a period of time with sexuality, they can't really get it out of their head. Now what do you do?
Excellent. I don't know.
Mom and dads, if you're not monitoring what your kid does online, effective right now, you need to be doing that. And I say that loudly and strongly. This is like putting your kid in front of a garbage can. I mean, it is toxic. It will destroy them.
So sexual offending has changed over the last 10 years. You know, everyone's, if you, in your mind's eye, you say, what's a sex offender? A sex offender is a guy lurking in the park looking for kids. They're not in the park anymore.
Nope.
They're online trying
to meet kids online.
And, you know, you can drive. The park is extremely safe.
It's safe.
But the internet
is not
fraught with danger.
And if you think that your daughter putting sort of sexy poses on Facebook is okay, let me tell you, there's about 1,000 pedophiles out there that are just having a great time watching her on Facebook of her video with her smartphone. I mean, I have no clue how we manage this, but it is out of control.
It is. So what tends to make the media a lot are a lot of these To Catch a Predator stings.
Yes.
It is police officers in their pajamas or at their house or in their precinct, and they are online posing as a hypersexual 13-year-old girl looking to meet a man. And all those guys are I want to say they're easy to catch, but there are
they're easy to catch.
There are thousands of them out there.
You know, an Admiral detective once told me, who was doing this work, that he said it's like shooting fish in a barrel. He said, I got 1,000 hits today. We can't process that many. We'll pick a few
right.
to make an example. But I mean, it is way out of control.
And the General Assembly has, if you intend to entice a child under 13 or 14 through the use of the internet or computer or telephone, then that's a 5-year mandatory minimum.
It is.
So that is a
serious offense.
Yeah, you don't even have to meet the child. It doesn't have to be a child. And you're gonna get 5 years.
And I always say, if a 68-year-old guy like me really believes that a 13-year-old girl wants to meet me and have sex, the problem is me, and not just sexually, but I mean in terms of I am in total la la land. I mean, these guys actually convince themselves that this person would want to get together with them. That's part of the problem.
So when we snag these guys, so when these guys come in, and they fall into two categories. They fall into, let's say you catch a guy who is the Albemarle County Police Department arrests a guy for soliciting a minor over the internet. They fall into two categories. They fall into a category with sort of the, I don't want to say Asperger-y, but they fall into sort of the guy in mom's basement.
Who never comes out.
Yeah, who's a shut-in, who has no social interaction. And child porn guys fall into that, too.
Most of them.
They just sort of, they go out on the internet and they sort
They're
of get
sad,
bored.
Sad, sad people.
And they get bored with
adult stuff.
And then they begin to explore other stuff. And they represent very little risk in the community to children. One, because they don't have access to them.
Correct.
And two, is
they lack any social skills to meet anybody.
They have no ability to get out there and interact to the point where anyone's even going to want to hang out with them, much less have sexual intercourse with them. But then there are the guys who we catch that actually have sexual interest in children and are using child pornography as a fill-in until they can actually
get hands on a kid.
Right. And that's...
That's a whole different ball game.
It's about 50-50, or
roughly,
is it?
Yeah, roughly.
So your job is, and the state, you know, there aren't unlimited resources.
No.
So what you have to do is through the use of the risk assessment, the use of the PPG and the ABLE and polygraphs, is you have to figure out which category they fall into. And if they fall into the guy in mom's basement, then there are other ways to go at we're helping this individual.
Correct.
But if they are someone that is, that you really have to heap your resources in that direction.
Absolutely. I want to mention, though, or interject that even for the guy in mom's basement, I don't want the listeners to think that's a victimless crime because a child was
absolutely
exploited in the making of that pornography. You know, my colleagues up at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children will tell you they monitor all the pornography on the internet. If a new clip comes through on their database, they will tell you they have 24 hours to locate that kid and get them out of that situation. If 24 hours passed, they can do nothing. And so much of this stuff now is coming out of the poorer countries in Eastern Europe.
It is, I thank you for clarifying. I meant by no means that it was it's a victimless crime. My point is that those guys they're not as risky as the
hands on
for the other guys.
Yes, absolutely correct.
And if you read some of the victim impact statements that I don't want to say what it is here on Straight Talk with 94 and 94.7, but what I want to do is you can Google and find victim impact statements of
child pornography
victims. And if you want to look at what that has done to them going forward 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years out.
And knowing that stuff's still out there, can you imagine? I mean, you feel violated every day.
It is, one of the things, that what that does is it just sits here, when I talk about it, it just makes me angry. And, we're all dads, and or at least in here, and just you can't, it's beyond belief that people would subject children to that for their own, one, gratification, and two, for sometimes they get money, and they do it because...
They're poor.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, right. Especially in those countries. You know, the hardest thing for me in this career was when I would have to go look at that stuff for a case to be able to say on the witness stand, yes, I looked at the images. I mean, you cannot get it out of your head.
You can't unsee it.
You can't not see it. You can't unring the bell, as they say. And it's just, that's one part of my job I do, since retiring, I do not miss. It is horrific.
Yeah, some of the guys and some of the ladies that I've worked with, state and local sheriffs and police departments and state police that do this for a living, I would never do their job. But two, the police world is sort of a macho world, and you ask them, what do you do for self-care? You know, cause you've got kids and you go home and you go to work and you see these horrific images.
Yes.
What do you do to help yourself? Well, I don't do anything. That's a mistake too.
Cause it's a huge mistake.
That person,
this stuff is traumatic to look at.
Right, it's the traumatization. When you uncover a cache of child pornography on someone's computer, and you've got to go through image by image
and catalog it,
and catalog it, and because it has to be a known image, so you have to run it through that database you were talking about to figure out, you know, because
the age and all the particulars for the conviction.
So it's not like you just look at it and move on. I mean, you've got to
study it,
and that.
It's horrible.
That has impact. And for you, what you have done, and I know you've done it for other attorneys in town, is you've always made yourself available to me and to other people to sort of come to your office or have coffee. And I was talking to an attorney here in town who I will not name. And they said, I said, are you in therapy for all this? And they said, no, it's not that a cup of coffee with Jeff Frazier can't help out with. So to the people, so I say thank you from my perspective, or from me personally, and for the other stuff that you've done for all the attorneys in town, because your hourly rate was pretty high. So we got about 9 more minutes to go.
I wanted to just say one more thing, if I could,
sure.
About these cases, especially the child porn cases, the number of times I would be asked to evaluate them by counsel, by the defense attorney, and when I'd come to them and I'd say, here's my evaluation, you probably want to throw it in the trash can. You know, and say, I once got challenged on the stand by a prosecutor who said, well, why are your evaluations favorable to the defendant? And I said, what do you think happens to the unfavorable ones?
Right. So for the...
they never see the light of day.
This is a legal show. So for those of you who aren't lawyers out there who are tuning in, what happens is a defense attorney who is representing a person who's tried or convicted of a sexual offense can request a defense evaluation. And when the defense evaluation is done, it is up to the defense attorney to introduce the evaluation into court.
If they choose.
Or not. And if they don't want to introduce it, it's attorney work product.
It's protected.
It's protected, and the prosecutor and the judge can't see it.
Correct.
So the only thing they'll let them see are the good reports.
Correct.
Because attorneys are, you know, attorneys should be, they need to be zealous advocates for their clients. And if your report says, you know, he's a fixated pedophile with violent psychopathic tendencies,
no attorney in his right mind. And oftentimes after I'd submit the report and it would get filed away, the judge might ask me to do an evaluation on this person. And all I could say was, I have a conflict, Your Honor. I can't say I evaluated him and he's a terrible risk. I mean, they understood what that meant, but it again protected the report, but also allowed me to get out of having to a conflict of interest.
Yeah, goodness. So one of the things, and we talk about recidivism. So sex offenders don't recidivate at that high of a level when they are compared to other individuals who are criminally involved.
Right. I mean, theft, drugs, correct. I mean, that's a huge misconception that they're all at risk to reoffend.
So I think the recidivism rate for the people that created the static was probably, what, about four? Untreated sex offenders have about, on average, 16% chance,
correct,
of recidivism. And treated sex offenders, I think it drops down to about 12%. And by treatment, it's psychotherapy, it's group therapy.
It's targeted sex offender treatment. It's not tell me, you know, about your mom. It's very targeted, just so the folks listening understand that. You can't send a sex offender to a generic therapist and expect them to get helped. You need, Virginia has a second licensure called Certified Sex Offender Treatment Provider. So you first have to have your license as a psychologist or whatever, and then you have the second certification. And those are the people you want seeing these offenders.
Yeah, and you work closely with sort of community-based supervision groups where one of the things that you do in that is you administer polygraphs.
Yes.
To people that are in sex offender treatment. So one of the polygraphs is a full sexual history polygraph, which think about having to sit and list everyone that you've ever had sexual contact with in your whole life. And some of the guys will come in and have nobody.
Yeah.
And have no
prior
intimate partners at all. And then some of the guys will come in with stuff that could be the topic for an additional show.
Yes.
So the reason they do that is because until these guys can acknowledge what they've done, they'll always be hiding something.
And they're never going to be better. They're never going to be lower risk.
Right. So it's
and it's powerful if only to scare them into giving up the information. I've loved how effectively you've used that instrument in your office and in your practice, in your caseload, Jeff, because you know it keeps these guys honest. And that, along with the group treatment there with a specialist,
mm-hmm.
has been very effective, and it's also been a huge benefit to the community.
Well, thanks. One of the things that you have to keep in mind when you're doing these things is people always respond better to affirmations than they do to punishment. So what you have to do is set reasonable, attainable goals for anybody. If you're raising children or you're supervising sex offenders or whatever you're doing, you have to give them incremental success so that they will see the reward of doing better. So when you are in therapy with someone, the hardest thing to do is to get them to trust you with the fact that they've got 50 victims. And invariably, right before they disclose what they've done, they will look and say, I expect to go to prison for what I'm about to tell you. And what I do after they disclose is I like to watch them go out the door, because they'll go out the door and expect to be jumped by the police. Or they'll go out the door and look around to make sure the cops aren't coming, which I'm a bit conflicted about, because you look at what they've done and you're like, oh man, that's not good.
It's not good.
But it's on their path to lower their, I don't want to say recovery, but it's on their path
to lower their
risk so that they can safely be in the community where our children live, and that's our goal.
Yes, you know, it reminds me of the mandatory reporting requirement that all professionals in the state have, meaning that if someone comes into me and discloses that they've offended, I have to report it. And once the word got out on that, I would get calls where someone would call up and not give me their name and say, this is what I've done. If I come in, do you have to report it? And I'd say, absolutely, and click. So it in that sense, it's a deterrent for people getting help. I understand the importance of the law, but again, there's always unintended consequences.
So you and I have talked about this a lot, and just to bring it home to sort of the listeners. So if, let's say two parents discover that their 12-year-old son was injuring sexually their 4-year-old daughter, and they're appropriately freaked out, and they bring them to you, you've got to report that.
I've got to.
And they're like, well, I didn't come to you to go to jail. I didn't come to you to get my son arrested. So your point is there's two sides of the coin. Is one, you're protecting the daughter, but yet it's also a disincentive for people to involve the professionals. If they're trying to handle it in a different way,
right? And it's not. It's also school personnel, caregivers. I mean, it's the requirement to report covers a number of entry points for folks.
And it's not a. It's the mandated reporting system isn't a suggestion.
No, I can be charged for failing to report.
It is a law that you can go to jail for not reporting. So with someone in our position, your position, my position, is your tendency is to over-report rather than under-report.
Absolutely.
Because if something seems not right, that you don't want to be the person that says you didn't report this.
But having said that, you and I have both been in a situation where we're conflicted because we feel like, damn, I'm going to lose the opportunity to really, you know, help this person, but you still got to do it.
So that's 94.7 WPVZ. That's Straight Talk for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
Thank you, Jeff, for
having
me.
Thank you.
This was fun.
We should do this again. I'd be anxious to see what our listeners' feedback is on this.
Because we really only scratched the surface. Yeah. I mean, this could be an ongoing, there's so much to talk about.
It really could. So, Jeff, thank you very much. You are a friend, and thank you for all that you've done to help me and to help the victims and to help everyone in the community.
Thank you for all the years of collaborating and working well together.
All right, stay tuned next week. We're coming up right now as El Club del Sabor, Charlottesville's only show, solamente en español.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August. Engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.